you know, there's all these fucking hurrah military shows, whatever. I don't expect a lot from CBS. Elementary.
I will not have you besmirch the name of my former employer like that, Anita. Okay. Two and a Half Men is a fine, fine CBS program.
Oh, my gosh. Uh-huh.
Welcome to Feminist Frequency Radio. This is episode 40, and I'm your host, Anita Sarkeesian. And I'm joined by my fellow economy class people, Ebony Astor.
I'm in steerage.
In steerage?
Yeah. I'm a step below. I'm in the cargo hold.
Steerage is where on the Titanic, like in the movie Titanic, the poor people have a happy Irish jig because being poor is so great.
Oh,
like they're the ones who really know how to suck the marrow
sure.
out of life.
Mm-hmm. And this is Carolyn Pettit,
yes.
who knows all about steerage.
And the James Cameron film Titanic.
She knows all about steerage.
Yeah.
This is the show that asks you to be critical of the media you love, or alternatively, where the feminist killjoy is coming for your media, depending on your perspective. In today's show, we're going to dive into the latest rom-com, Crazy Rich Asians. And as always, we'll finish the show by all sharing a little something in What's Your Freakout? Exclusively for our fantastic backers, we've got a bonus segment. And if you want access to it, along with some other fun perks, join our podcast community at d.rip/femfreak. Now on with the show. What's up, y'all?
Monday.
Yeah, I'm a little thrown off right now because I had a nasty headache on Saturday, which kind of kept me in bed until like in the afternoon. And then I got up at around 5 p.m. and then I just couldn't sleep at all. So
yeah.
I actually streamed on our Twitch channel until 6 a.m.
Oh,
holy
my God,
shit.
Carol.
Yeah. So, which, you know, a lot of people enjoyed, which was great. You know, people who are like, oh, yeah, I actually finally get to catch like a stream, you know, because we have people all over the world and the times that we usually stream don't really work out for them. So it was fun. But obviously the drawback is that now my body is all completely confused about.
I think that means you need to just go to Europe then.
I think, yeah.
I think that's what that means.
That way I can stream primetime European hours all the time.
Yeah. I went hiking this weekend at this place that it's like mostly outdoor. It's called Pinnacles National Park.
Oh.
But it has these giant, huge rock formations and these enormous boulders. It feels like prehistoric.
Yeah.
And there's parts of the hike where you actually like have to crawl through a cave.
Oh,
and
no,
sometimes
ma'am.
Don't know where you're going. And like there's these teeny tiny little arrows that point your direction, but you don't see them unless you see them. It was cool.
No, that sounds really, like fun. Yeah. I'd love to do that.
I was super into it.
It sounds
was,
like what?
Hot.
F-U-N.
Ebony, how was your weekend since we're going around? And
it was great. And part of the reason it was great is It was great. And part of the reason it was great is because I saw Crazy Rich Asians and just, you know, it set me up for just a like whimsical, fun, loving life kind of weekend. I spent the rest of the weekend napping, but, you know, whatever.
Sure, sure. That would have been a great transition, except we're not going to that yet. So, Carolyn, about the news?
So let's start with a story that's sort of, you know, it sort of teeters on the edge of like entertainment news, but because it also in a weird way links to Crazy Rich Asians, I'm gonna start with this. So news came out in the past week that at one point during a meeting with some advocates and advisors from Vietnam veterans, you know, advocacy groups, there was a little an odd conversation that took place between them and Donald Trump. Because they were saying, you know, there hasn't been enough progress made on issues related to Agent Orange. And President Trump responded at a certain point. He said, asked if Agent Orange was, quote, that stuff from that movie. He didn't say what movie. It wasn't initially clear, but, you know, through process of deduction, the attendees eventually figured out that he was referring to Apocalypse Now, and like particularly the famous, you know, helicopter attack scene accompanied by Flight of the Valkyries, which is directly referenced in Crazy Rich Asians. And then this just completely like derailed the conversation. They weren't talking anymore about like veterans issues. He went around and like polled people whether, oh, was the stuff in the movie Agent Orange or was it Napalm? And, like, everyone was like, no, sir, that was Napalm. That was not Agent Orange. And then, like, finally, completely unable to admit that he was, may have been wrong about this, his final, like, flippant response was just like, well, I think you just didn't like the movie. Which has nothing to do with whether it was Napalm or, you know, or Agent Orange.
Oh, boy.
So this is, you know, as one person on Twitter sort of, you know, pointed out, it's like, it's insightful, you know, not that we need this insight into Trump's ego at this point, but it's like his fundamental, like, inability to, like, admit that he might be wrong or to even take in, like, new information, right? He's, because he knows what he knows. He just thinks he knows what he knows, and that's it. Oh, God. Anyway.
Yeah, and just, like, the way everything for him has to be a competition with a clear winner and loser, like, every conversation, every interaction, right? So if someone disagrees with him, it means that they are calling into question something fundamental about, like, he'll go to the mat about the stupidest things and can't just be like, oh, you know, I thought it was something else, or, hey, I disagree, or whatever. Like, it's all, he has to take everything to the nth degree and, you know, try and get that slam dunk. And he's a fucking idiot.
He sure is.
In sort of more pleasant or heartwarming news, there was an interview that Rebecca Sugar, the, I believe, like, creator and showrunner of Steven Universe, did with Entertainment Weekly. And it contained this statement from her about the importance of representing, of giving children, like, LGBTQ kind of, models and in media. She said, we need to let children know that they belong in this world. You can't wait to tell them that until after they grow up or the damage will be done. You have to tell them while they're still children that they deserve love and that they deserve support and that people will be excited to hear their story. When you don't show any children stories about LGBTQIA characters and then they grow up, they're not going to tell their own stories because they're going to think that they're inappropriate, and they're going to have a very good reason to think that because they've been told that through their entire childhood. Realizing that changed everything for me. And, you know, that just really certainly hit home for me as somebody who didn't really see models of, you know, queer or really or trans or genderqueer representation when I was growing up. So, you know, good for her for being so committed to that in the work she's doing on Steven Universe.
Yeah. I mean, do y'all watch Steven Universe?
No.
I watched the first season.
I keep up with it. I love the show. And I love how from the very beginning, this was a fundamental part of the characterization of the characters that we get in there. And so, like, it wasn't something that happened later once the show was, like, safely a hit, you know? Like, this was there from the very beginning. I love this show so much. So good. Oh.
Yeah, I've heard really good things. I keep meaning to catch up. I like to keep watching it because it apparently gets, like, really big into issues of consent and mm-hmm. all kinds of really cool
trauma.
Stuff. But I just, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, one more thing real quick before we move on. Just a sort of follow-up on a story that we discussed last week, the you know, prominent Fortnite streamer Ninja, who had kind of stated that why he doesn't stream with female, you know, Twitch streamers or Fortnite players. So Megan Farokhmanesh at Polygon tweeted, and this is, I think, so central to not only this issue.
She's with The Verge now.
Oh, excuse me, The Verge. Yeah. Thank you. Yes, thank you for that correction.
It's okay.
This is so fundamental, not only to this conversation, but to so many conversations that we have about these kinds of issues. Megan tweeted, final ninja thought for y'all wilding out and rushing to yell, what if the situation were reversed with a woman making the same statement? It's not the same. We can't even play the what if game because that assumes we're speaking about an equal playing field. And it's just so true that, like, power imbalances, right, are so often kind of erased in these conversations. Like, a woman saying, you know, well, I don't want to stream with male players is, in my mind, completely understandable if she constantly has experienced, like, abuse or objectification or harassment at the hand, you know, so creating, like, going on Twitch and saying, like, I'm just going to stream with my female friends. And also, like, women do not have the dominant position in that space. So it's not the same at all when a man kind of makes the same, quote unquote, same statement. And that's you know, that's just the way it is. And if it seems unfair to you, well, then you're not understanding, like, the big picture and the underlying power imbalances that, you're right, it's not fair. It's not fair for women. Like, no matter what, right now, it's not fair for women. It's not like it's not fair for Ninja. Like, anyway, such a... Yeah.
Yeah.
Grr.
I can't believe that fucking story.
What was that, Anita?
I said, I can't believe that fucking story. Men. Am I right?
Oh, man.
All right. Let's dive into our main subject for this week. Crazy Rich Asians is a romantic comedy that follows Rachel Chu to Singapore from New York to meet her boyfriend's family, who turns out to be disgustingly rich, and antics ensue. Two things I want to say real quick is I keep saying romantic comedy, and in the back of my head, I keep hearing people be like, meh. Rom-coms are often associated with women, so they're denigrated and said that they're not, like, good movies or popular or important movies. So I'm not, just like to clarify that, like, this is in that genre and that doesn't degrade the film.
Right.
And also the title says crazy. We on this podcast try to avoid using that word because it is ableist.
It's the title.
And I feel like an ass being like, but it's the title, so we have to use it. But, you know, just be conscious of, like, that is an unfortunate title for the book and the movie. And, you know, it reinforces some ableist narratives that we don't like. Mm-hmm. But here we are.
Yeah.
Okay. I feel very up and down about this movie.
Yeah, me too.
And I kind of just want to... Okay. I'm going to start with some things I don't like. And then we'll go into the things I do. There's some lines in this movie that are fucking hilarious that just made me cackle. I feel like the unofficial tagline of this movie is, it's okay to be rich. And that really bothers me. So, you know, like, there's class conversations in this that are important, but the storyline with the really nice sister or cousin or whatever, the one that gets the $1 million earrings...
Mm-hmm. Right. Astrid. The one who's dealing with marriage, like, issues. Yeah.
So there's an interesting thing around, like, her husband is quote unquote a commoner. And so she married someone below her class. And that is the theme of this movie, is like class structures and who is worthy and who isn't because of their background and their finances and that sort of thing. But there's all this stuff with her. So I was like, okay, interesting. Where is this going to go? And then towards the end, there's a moment where she has these, like, these earrings that she bought that were $1 million that she was hiding from her husband because she didn't want to make him feel bad about her shopping habits. And she, like, puts them on and we're supposed to root for her. Like, right. You're supposed to be all like, oh, yeah, you can proudly wear your $1 million earrings now where you couldn't before. Like, fuck off. Like, those things
I loved the way she hid her stuff because it was such a bootleg, half-ass kind of hiding of her luxury goods. Like, she slipped it into a drawer and then just, like, casually tossed a handkerchief on top of it. And, like, the $1 million earrings were on top of a mirror or whatever. But, like, clearly in line of sight. I mean, I know this wasn't the point, but I was just like, you really don't care if he sees that stuff to you because you're not really hiding it.
Yeah, and let's also talk about the fact that she wasn't the one hiding it. It was her fucking army of servants that were hiding all of it and doing that labor, right? Like, they're the class. Sorry, they're the class in this movie that is not talked about.
Exactly. And, like, Rachel is an economics professor, and I really wanted.
Okay, hold on. Actually, sorry. I know I said what it was. So Nick Young is her, her boyfriend. Right. He has a rich family. Rachel Chu is the economics professor at NYU.
Yeah.
That's so, just so that you're clear on who the characters are.
Right. And, I really wanted more about, like, economics, the ethics of economics in this film, to be honest. Like, you know, in my mind, it's, of course, it's immoral to be as rich as the Chu family is, like, to be half as rich, to be a quarter as rich. Like, because if you're that incredibly rich, it means you're not, like, paying the people who made your wealth, who helped create your wealth enough, or, you know, and or you're not paying enough in taxes or whatever. There's like income inequality is a massive problem, not just here in the U.S., but, you know, in other parts of the world as well. And I guess, like there's a throwaway line at one point where Rachel at this wedding says to this woman who, I guess this woman wrote an article about economics. And Rachel says like something like, oh, I really like that article. I think you made a great point about how microloans like empower women to, you know, create their own businesses or this or that. But it's just this like total throwaway line that's only used so that Rachel can kind of sit in the front row or something at this like wedding ceremony. It's not like the film is not actually concerned with those things. And given that this film is so much about wealth and excess, but it doesn't really, it doesn't in any way think critically about that, to the point where there's a wedding ring that has a giant green emerald on it. And the audience that I saw the film with, you know, gasped in awe, like this film wants to in some way say, well, Rachel, Rachel has value as a person, despite coming from not coming from this kind of tradition and this kind of wealth. And yet we're all supposed to totally kind of understand and root for her to be like seduced by that world of wealth and kind of want to participate in it on some level, or be happy for her that she gets that quote unquote happy ending of, I wanted her and the two of them to kind of, I wanted them to like walk away from his family and his wealth, which seems at one point like it might be a thing. That would have been for me like an ethical statement. But obviously, of course, this being that kind of traditional rom-com, like that's not what happens.
And I just want to say really quick, sorry, Ebony. I came out of the gate with like, I don't like these things about the movie because it's really been bothering me since I watched it. But I do want to say like, and we can talk about this, but like it is really in terms of representation.
Oh, yeah.
That this like this film and the way it's set up and who's in it and all of that is important. And I'm glad it exists. So
100%.
I just want to put that out there.
Too late. You've already been canceled. Yeah. I think my reaction to the film along the like economics axis was pretty different from yours. My sense is that, or rather my reading is that although, you know, this is a rom-com that, you know, like elevates the kind of, supreme wealth kind of fantasy to its absolute height, you know, nevertheless, the fundamental tension in this film is not about poor girl, rich guy, but it is in fact about Asian Americans going to Asia and the tension between people going to a place where, you know, the folks look like you, but the culture is different in ways that perhaps you hadn't anticipated. And so there are many times in which Eleanor, Nick's mother, her problems with Rachel stem not from the fact that, you know, Rachel comes from a less privileged background, but the fact that she is not Singaporean, you know, like she does not carry the kind of cultural markers that, yes, someone in her class would, but also someone who has lived, you know, in that region would have versus someone who has what she calls American values. But then going back to the microloan, I think there's something really interesting going on there. I certainly don't, you know, agree necessarily with Rachel's kind of wholehearted support of it. But I think it is important that the person that she's talking to is a Malaysian princess. Like it's not just some, you know, random guest at the wedding, you know, like I think there is something going on there.
Yeah. I think, you know, 95% of people who see this film won't even pick up on that because the film, you know, it's introducing and establishing so many characters so quickly that like the smaller people in that or the people have smaller roles in that orbit barely read like I don't know. I mean, I agree. I just don't think the film really makes a point of that in the way that I guess I wish it did.
I don't know. I wonder about stuff like that because I do think one of the things that's been really interesting about the discussion surrounding this film since, you know, it's sort of like we first learned that it was being made and then through the casting, et cetera, is the question that we're always tackling, like, who is this for, right? And so reading the different reactions from Asian-American audiences and, for instance, I know we're going to talk about this later, but that crucial Mahjong scene, right? But the way in which this film doesn't explain, it sort of doesn't subtitle itself, right? And so I do
think that there are things
that perhaps we aren't picking up on that Asian American audiences are going to pick up on. So I don't know how fair it is to say that, you know, that might not because it might not sort of resonate with us immediately, that it's not going to resonate in the same way with the Asian American audience that I think this film takes pains to foreground.
No, that's an excellent point, and that's totally fair.
Since you just talked about the Mahjong thing, let's talk about it, because I think it's related to what you were talking about just a minute earlier.
Can we talk about how at the very end of that scene, when Rachel's mom, Carrie, gives that look to Eleanor across the street, that shit was frightening. Like, the kind of mama bear that popped out when she gave her that look. Like, if you say boo to my child one more time, I'm going to get all up in that ass. I don't care how rich you are. So good. It was my favorite part of the movie.
But in that scene, the Michelle Yeoh's character, who, God, she's
Eleanor.
So delightful.
Eleanor. Yeah.
It's talking, what you were talking about earlier is the sort of American versus Asian ideals and values. And like throughout the film, she's saying things like Americans only think about their own happiness, that we don't know how Americans don't know how to build things that last. Right. And it's this really, you know, like, as a non-Asian American person and looking at that and seeing that conversation, right? Like, you look at the mother as, you know, this feels very generational. And I don't know if it's generational or if it's cultural, but like, that's also my parents' generation feels that way. Like, you sacrifice everything to have babies and work and raise money, right? Raise money to take care of your family. Yeah. And it's a very traditional role where the wife does all of the rearing and house, you know, house things.
Yeah, yeah.
They build the house, whatever. Yeah, yeah, no. Yeah. And so that was, I think, something that's happening in this as well, in terms of like generational conflict in terms of gender roles.
Absolutely. And I was fascinated by the way that, this is not like a criticism of the film, because this is just the film kind of being true to what this conflict is rooted in, is the ways in which like that comes with us with certain kind of patriarchal ideals. Like when Eleanor says, you know, I put family first, what she means is I took the traditional like wife and mother role so that my husband could go and become this like extremely successful businessman. And to go back to the subplot about the extremely rich, you know, woman with her quote unquote commoner husband, like there's a line at the end, like the big kind of twist the knife line that she says to him is something like,
it's not my job to make you feel like a man. I can't make you feel like something you're not.
Yeah, exactly. Like the way that
which let's talk about that for a second.
It's so complicated.
So in my audience, someone like went, woo! It was really funny, and everyone started laughing. It was not me, because and I will tell you why it was not me. The notion of what a man is, like, I will always have an issue with like act like a man or be a man or that sort of thing. And while there was something very satisfying in what she was saying, because it did feel like she was constantly trying to lower her, not lower in terms of class, but like make herself smaller and make herself more invisible so that her husband didn't feel bad.
Yeah.
That watching her grow out of that was really empowering. It's just the money part of it is super disturbing to me.
Right. I mean, it is absolutely true that, I mean, there's something to what she's saying in the sense that it is his like fragile masculinity to some degree that probably makes him feel like, oh, if I'm not the provider, if I'm not the one who's bringing in the money, then I'm a failure. Whereas she never felt that way. And like she, I think, would have been happy in the marriage if he had not had those deep insecurities, you know, that he couldn't like talk about or that drove him to be with another woman. So it's like on that sense, it's like, you shouldn't, you know, like be quote unquote a man by not buying into this traditional idea that you have to be the provider. You know, that's where things get really like interesting and kind of twisted around.
Yeah, totally. Can we talk about Awkwafina and her family and how amazing she was? No, not the family. She was fucking great.
Yeah, she was great.
Okay.
There's some line. Okay, when they do the, hold on, where are my notes? When they are going through the montage with the outfits, okay, clown's tampon on a heavy day.
I liked that dress. One of the descriptions
too.
I was like, I saw that dress and I was like, that looks really pretty. And then they said that and I'm like, oh, I can never look at that dress the same way again.
And then slutty Ebola virus. Mm-hmm. I was just, oh my God, that shit was cracking me up. And she has some really super great moments in this film. I love the way that she describes JFK. Oh, no, that's Rachel. Rachel describes JFK, the airport, as salmonella and despair because she walks into, like, an Asian airport, which I've only been in one, and they're fucking amazing, right? Like, they do not want you to be sad or miserable in your travel experience.
Ah, weird.
Anyways, so Awkwafina, I forget what her name is in the show, but her family, I really found troubling, right? Her brother?
Especially her brother, she has this creeper brother who's always taking photos of Rachel, and it's totally played as kind of like, oh, he's kind of a cute loser. It's played for laughs. Like, there's a moment toward the end where the whole audience that I was seeing it with, like, you know, he's like lurking while Rachel and her mom have this conversation, and then she's like, how long have you been standing there? And he's like, just a short while.
And they all start laughing.
Exactly, they all start laughing. It's like, creeper dudes like that are not funny. It's not cute. It's fucked up.
And the dad sets it up when he's like, who are you dating? Well, you should date my son. You have a nice backside. Like, you know, it's just, I can't with that shit. And he just keeps taking, like, these pictures of her, and it's supposed to be funny.
Exactly.
And it's not.
Yeah. So I have liked Awkwafina in the past, and I like her in this film, too. But one of the things that I was kind of bracing myself for before going in to see this film was a conversation that a lot of folks on social media were having about the way she slips in and out of a black scent when the role calls for, like, a particularly kind of sassy line reading, and I have a lot of problem with that. There are times when, you know, to kind of emphasize the down to earth, you know, kind of like just funny, to the point, bold as brass, best friend character that's, you know, rife throughout the rom-com genre, you know, Awkwafina, whose career prior to her acting career has been built upon, like, proximity to black cool, as I say, dips into this kind of black scent that I was like, I'm not feeling it. Luckily, it wasn't throughout the whole movie, because I swear to God, I would have walked out. Like, I honestly can't handle when people dip in and out of what they think is this kind of, like, urban patois, and feel as if they kind of own access to, you know, black cool through language. So, like I said, luckily that didn't happen, but I was braced for that because I knew that it was going to occur, you know, because she's done it in other roles. And as I said, like, her career prior to her acting career was kind of based in that. But the thing that I actually found more troubling about, like, her, let me go back and say, I liked this movie. I liked this movie a whole lot. There are things absolutely that I was like, I'm not so sure about this, but I was so won over by the cotton candy confection of it. That I just, whatever, I was giving it all kinds of passes. But the thing that really kind of unsettled me about Awkwafina's family was the way the film sets up this really kind of cliche distinction between old money and new money, right? So, yeah, let's have the conversation about how anyone who's rich, you know, has to get that money and attain that level through the exploitation of others, but also this very kind of snobbish understanding of, like, old money is classy and beautiful and well turned out, and they eat these, you know, wonderful things. New money, it was like Talladega Nights or something, right? It was like they're eating chicken nuggets on the table. Their clothes are, you know, the people are not thin and sort of well turned out. You know, they're loud. They're kind of vulgar, etc. I was really kind of put off by that a little bit.
They make the joke about how the house was inspired by Donald Trump's bathroom, which is directly what you're talking about, like the kind of tackiness.
Just this very kind of Rococo understanding of it. And it's like, yeah, but, you know, let's be real here. It may be that, you know, people who wear Cartier versus, you know, the high level jeweler that Astrid go to is like, it's it's different, but it's all money. Like, it's all vulgar in a way. It's just one has, you know, attained a level of, like, you know, social acceptability in a way that others don't. And it was just, I don't know, it was funny to me because I was like, y'all all rich, you know? So let's just let's just break it down right there. Like, y'all all fucking rich.
Speaking of jewelry, you know, on the airport hangar thing where Rachel is talking to the family lawyer, I have earrings. And they are not fancy, expensive earrings at all. Just saying. They're just wanted everyone to know that.
I had so many moments where I wished I was watching this movie with you, Anita. And can you guess what those moments were? It was about the food. When they were in the street market, you know, eating that street food, I was like, I know right now Anita is losing her diggity daggone mind and is booking a trip to Singapore right damn now. And I'm ready to go
with you.
Like, okay, there were times when I felt like I was watching a particularly slick and well done, like, travel show in those moments. But I was like, this is the most amazing sort of introduction for so many people to the beauty of global cultures that they know nothing about, right? And yeah, it's sad that it has to happen through these, you know, crazy rich people that, you know, like, who have access to things we'll never have access to. But I was like, yo, just look at this. There are so many people who have no idea what Singapore is like as a country, the wealth and breadth of that nation, you know, like the richness of it, not in terms of finances, but just like culturally rich. And so, like, I just wanted to dive backwards into it and just doggy paddle through that food market. Oh my God, it looks so good.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, I definitely, like, there was a moment early on in this film where, like, I'm like gasping at the beauty of, you know, of some of what we're seeing, and certainly like the street market and the food and everything. And like, I was almost angry in a way that, like, I'm 41 years old and this is the first time in my life that I'm seeing like a film on, you know, made in the U.S., released mainstream, getting a mainstream release in the U.S. that shows Singapore at all, like, as a setting. And like, yeah, like Ebony, like you were saying, like, this is going to be so many people's first exposure to this. And I mean, cinema is so important in terms of kind of broadening our horizons, giving us a sense of the world that we live in, of the places that exist that most of us, you know, will never have, like, the money or the opportunity or the freedom to, like, travel to. And, like, why it's so frustrating that, like, it's like, this is the first time in my life that I'm seeing this kind of, in many ways, breathtaking, you know, beautiful landscape, like, which, yeah, it's so important. And yeah,
that said, I don't know that much about Singapore, but politically is a fucking nightmare.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And like, in terms of class, like, I think that the servant class in Singapore is this is another thing that's not addressed, is that, like, the political structure is very corrupt. The servant class in Singapore, I think, are Filipinos, like, which in a movie about class doesn't address that at all.
Yeah.
Because of what the movie's trying to do. It's trying to stay light to some degree.
Yeah, I mean, of course, like, when we're at that street market, and, like, obviously I'm sure the proprietors of those, like, food stands that and everything that they're purchasing food from are on the lower rungs of society, but the film doesn't, like, concern itself with them or their experience at all.
I was totally fucking enamored with that food scene.
Oh, it looked,
and
my God.
It was great. And they were talking about how, like, each stall perfects one thing, and just that was so delightful. But the shot of bingsu, which is the shaved ice, I literally gasped. I was like, and like, people around me in the theater looked over at me because I was just like, like, memories of how
so other people were gasping about the giant emerald ring. But you were like,
no, I was asking for the food. I think that, so a couple of things at the beginning. I think the pacing at the beginning was really weird. But my two favorite things at the beginning were the food montage and the gossip montage.
Yeah.
I thought they did that so elegantly, like, not elegantly, but really, really well. It was fascinating to watch. And the visual diagrams and the pop-ups and the way that they did it, the way they did it visually was really, really good.
It's entertaining. It looks great, and it accurate, I mean, I don't know accurately, but it definitely effectively communicates the interconnected, kind of tight-knit, you know, world that Nick comes from, right?
Yep. Oh, totally.
Yeah.
So, but I thought some of the pacing at the beginning was a little bit off. This is super minor, but like, you know, they do establish that his mom doesn't want his girlfriend to come out, right? But like, the whole first chunk of the movie is just this sort of really happy-go-lucky, we're in love, look at all this great food, look at all this good times, blah, 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 blah. And it just like, I kind of wanted it to like build tension a little faster. Like it was just a little, I was like, okay, cool. Got it. You've already established this relationship. Let's get going in the story. But don't take out the food montage.
Yeah. I mean, I want to say for my part that like it's, we've been mainly discussing our various numerous kind of critiques of the film, but I absolutely, like Ebony, I think I walked out of this film with a little spring in my step. Like it worked on me. I was happy for, you know, for Nick and
Rachel. Hold up.
Okay.
If I was on that fucking plane,
yeah.
And they held up the plane for a goddamn... I was like, no, the whole time I'd be so mad.
Okay, this is where I'm gonna again be like the Shape of Water thing. Like, it's a rom com. It's supposed to be this cute scenario.
Yeah, but it might inspire people to do that shit, and they do that on my planes.
No, I'm 100% with you. Like, this is it's just a movie. People don't, you know. I mean, I wish that, you know, it had these political perspectives and this and that. And I feel like it's really interesting when you have a film like this that is so important and landmark and progressive in terms of its representation and tells a story about people whose stories are almost never told and puts those images on screen, you know, while kind of totally at the same time reinforcing so much about, like, the capitalist, you know, status quo. And it's like so I feel torn, but 100% glad that you know that this film exists, right? Because it is like, I don't want to take anything away from the importance of this film, and or even like the skill with which it's constructed as a rom-com, the joy, the kind of traditional, like the structure, the three-act structure, the way it all pays off, you know, it's great. I mean, it's great.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the fact that we haven't seen a mainstream film with an all Asian cast since fucking Joy Luck Club. Come on. It's been 25 years, you know? Just like,
You can
hear like the exhalation of people in the Asian and Asian American community who are like, finally, you know, just to see, okay, yeah, it's like I said, it's a cotton candy confection. So yeah, these people are living, these beautiful people are living lives on screen that 99.9% of us will never have a hope of approximating if we even wanted to. But just the power of seeing someone who looks like you on screen, someone who looks like you be happy and funny and ridiculous and smart and conniving and, you know, evil, and then have a redemption and have a happy ending. Just all of it, the breadth of it, you know, like this movie is so... It is so small in a way, in terms of like the vast majority of the stories that could be told. It's one tiny thing, but it is so huge in its resonance and its effect. You know, I saw the film on Saturday with an audience that was, I want to say, maybe one third Asian, maybe, you know, primarily white audience. But I mean, listen. Getting people out to see this film and the incredible success that it's had is just going to open up so many doors for people. And yeah, so maybe as those doors get open, as we start to see new people and hear new stories, we'll start to get things that, you know, are maybe a little bit more nuanced, maybe are a little bit more, you know, politically, you know, aware. For this one, it was just like, yo, I'm gonna let y'all have everything and more, because this is just delicious. It's just delicious.
Yeah, I mean, in our work, you know, we'll often talk about how, well, I mean, you know, with white people, you know, you any kind of white male hero or character that you have is not going to reinforce negative stereotypes about white people, largely because, you know, of white supremacy and white people being in positions of power, you know, in everything. But also because, like, there's such a breadth of representations. You have all kinds of white people on screen that no one image is going to, like, be a quote, like, a stereotype that's going to have any kind of, like, power. And, like, you know, but an Asian people, Asian characters have for so long, you know, in Hollywood cinema have been, if they exist at all, it's in these very kind of stereotypical roles. And so, as you say, Ebony, yeah, like having movies like this where we see all different kinds of people, you know, with all different kinds of personalities and, you know, everything, you know, it absolutely works to challenge that. There's a great piece actually in the and Deadline Hollywood, I guess, or Deadline.com, about, or an interview and conversation and kind of profile of James Hong, who's this 89-year-old actor. And if you see his face, like, you'll probably know, like, oh, I've seen that guy. He's been, like, any movie where there's, like, you know, an Asian man, you know, almost, like, oh, he was in this. And anyway, saying, and the headline is, like, James Hong, 89-year-old Chinese-American actor, quote, I never thought it would take this long. And it charts his whole, like, he has been in Hollywood literally working since the 50s. And it charts, like, his whole life and career and political kind of involvement and activism pushing for this. And what a landmark watershed moment this is. And how awful on one, you know, how great that it's here, how awful that it had to take this long. And again, like, it's kind of the Black Panther question, too, of, like, is this actually going to signify a change going forward? I mean, certainly, like, there's also a comedy that just came out on Netflix called To All the Boys I've Loved Before, which has a female Asian protagonist and which people are raving about. I haven't seen it yet. You know, there's a, I saw a trailer for an upcoming film called Searching with starring, I just blanked on his name. Oh my God. The great, like, I feel so bad that I literally just popped out of my head. The guy who plays, you know, Sulu in the Star Trek movies.
John Cho?
Yeah, John Cho, yeah. So it's sort of like, okay, great, but I really hope that this is it's not just some flash in the pan moment of like, oh, let's give Asian Americans their moment and then move on, but rather that it's indicative of a kind of lasting, you know, change.
Yeah, totally. All right, y'all.
Can I ask you guys a quick question about that wedding scene? In the movie, because, oh my gosh.
What, you didn't like the water?
Yeah, because I was down torn the river thinking, this is the cheesiest thing I've ever seen in my life, to being completely captivated and being mad when the camera would pan back to Rachel and Nick. And I was like, yeah, I get it. I don't care. Whatever. Go back to this, like, gold sequin fairy dress. I didn't understand what was happening in that $40 million wedding where
it was so cheesy and bad. Holy moly.
Yeah.
No, yeah. No.
Yes. I say yes. I want everyone to walk down the aisle barefoot in, you know, a sparkly onesie from now on. I want that to be the new wedding tradition.
Oh, Jesus. And now it's time for What's Your Freak Out? Carolyn, what's your freak out?
My freak out, you know, I like to sometimes shine a spotlight on things that are overlooked, things that are kind of overshadowed, that don't get the attention that I feel that they deserve. And this, you know, this week is a pretty good example of that. There's this little game on, you know, PCs and Switch and Xbox and PS4 called Fortnite. And So Fortnite is this huge, obviously, sensation.
You're just gonna brag about coming in second, huh?
I mean, that was super exciting. That was super exciting. I have to. So for anyone who doesn't know, real quick, Fortnite is it's a gaming sensation right now, and the basic format of the mode that's really popular anyway is it's called Battle Royale, which, similar to, you know, PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds and a few other games. It's 100 players get just dropped onto an island and, you know, eliminate each other until there's one left. And obviously, like, you know, I'm a little whatever, uncomfortable with, you know, everyone kill each other until there's one person left. But there's something about, like, at first I didn't get it. Like, but then I spent some time streaming it and a little more time this weekend playing it. And the more I played, it's like, there's a wonderful kind of art style and like tone to the game's island setting, because it has all these like distinct locations that, you know, you travel from one part of the island to another and they feel really different and kind of just like there's a great sense of just place to the game. I think the setting is excellent. So just exploring the island itself, it becomes really fun and enjoyable. I think that, I spent some time playing kind of co-op with other people, and just as kind of a co-op or friendly, like, social experience, it's great. And I don't have anything particularly insightful to say, but other than just I'm on the Fortnite train now, and There's something special about this game, like, and it's free. So if they make tons of money by charging people $20 for like an outfit, like a limited outfit that, you know, all those stuff has no impact whatsoever on gameplay. It's purely cosmetic, but God, they're making ridiculous amounts of money, but it's free to play. So yeah, Fortnite, it's cool. I like it. Nice.
That was just a great wrap up for that. It's cool. I like it.
Ebony, what's your freak out this week?
So after having watched Crazy Rich Asians, I decided that I needed to spend more time luxuriating in Amelia, you know, filmically, narratively, that I'll never enter in life. So wanted to hang out with some more rich people. Was reading and watching a lot of P.G. Woodhouse this weekend. So P.G. Woodhouse, for those of you who don't know, English humorist, writer, just amazing comic writer. And if people do know him but haven't read him, it's probably for like the Jeeves and Wooster stories and the adaptation that starred Hugh Laurie and Stephen Fry in the 90s. And so, yeah, I've just been listening to a lot of P.G. Woodhouse on audio book, watching Jeeves and Wooster stories on, you know, like binge watching them from my bed. And it just I love the way that I, a black woman with the opposite of money, completely surrender to this world that could not be more foreign to me. This world of wealth and privilege and inherited social stature of the British aristocracy, you know, and how I laugh along and just love it. And, you know, I have my favorite characters and I, you know, tut tut at them and, you know, laugh about their foibles and whatever. And I'm just like, what the fuck am I doing? Like, what? This is how people fall for the okie doke in terms of class, right? We are encouraged to sympathize with, you know, like people in an aspirational strata. But whatever, I had a good time. P.G. Woodhouse, you know, doing a shout out to someone who is writing at the turn of the 20th century. You want to get new stuff? Listen to Caro. I ain't got no new stuff for you. I got old stuff.
All right. My freak out is Elementary, because
it's great.
Ebony and I are just gonna bounce back and forth with our freak outs, apparently. Okay, so I've been hardcore binging to catch up. Been watching season 5, and I'm almost caught up on season 6, which is the current season. And I just want to talk about one particular aspect of it. CBS, we talk about, is super conservative. It's like, you know, there's all these fucking haram military shows, whatever. I don't expect a lot from CBS. Elementary.
I will not have you besmirch the name of my former employer like that, Anita. Okay. Two and a Half Men is a fine, fine CBS program.
Oh, my gosh.
Uh-huh. Oh, so, how are you enjoying Young Sheldon, Carol?
Oh, I'm contractually obligated to say for life that Young Sheldon is a fine, fine CBS program.
Okay, so we've talked about how, so I think that Elementary is a really beautiful, interesting, progressive take on the Sherlock narrative that we all know and have had many iterations of. And there was a moment where Joan is talking about maybe having a baby and having a baby in the house and understanding that Sherlock would not like that because he's, you know, very set in his ways. And there's just this beautiful moment where he says, "For you, Watson, I'd adjust." And I almost started crying. Mm-hmm. I was like, just the growth of their relationship and Sherlock. Like, I skipped a couple of seasons. And watching the growth of Sherlock really trying to be more human, caring and compassionate to the people around him that he cares about, and learning to recognize that care and how to express that. And there's just been a lot of that I've been really, really loving.
As somebody who doesn't watch the show, quick question, like, there's never been anything romantic.
No,
that is great, so
which is great.
Great.
Yeah, 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 and yeah, that is actually brought up in an episode. Mm. And it's really, really awesome that it's this genuine, deep, deep family, like familial mm-hmm. friendship mm-hmm. and care that they have for one another that doesn't seem like it's ever going to go in that direction.
Right.
Which that's what your fanfic is for. So fine, right? Like, I love that they're not doing that on the show, and it's just their relationship. Anyway, that's actually not what I wanted to talk about, but something that I love about it. They keep doing these very, very minor, small, progressive moments that show you the values that the writers have on this show. And I love the subtlety of it, and I love how it comes out. So it'll be, I wish I had noted all of these as I've been watching them. So I'm just trying to remember as I binge so much of them. But there's a moment where, you know, Sherlock at one point says he, she, or they. Right. Just to acknowledge the existence of non-binary folks, which is such a sad thing to say because it shouldn't be that minor. But the fact that that was included in, like, we're trying to find this person and we don't know what their gender is. Right. And they could have various genders. Mm-hmm. You know, they sort of call out misogyny and racism sometimes in subtle ways. So there's one example that I've totally blanked on. But, you know, like, it's just this, it's a comment. It's a throwaway comment that will acknowledge that whatever this person had just said or done is super fucking racist. And they just say it. They just say it. Another example, which isn't as clear, but is, I think they should have done more with this one. So the term Eskimo is an offensive term. The accepted nomenclature here is Inuit. So the word Eskimo comes up a couple of times in an episode, but Sherlock always says Inuit. So nobody corrects anybody, but there is a showing of what the other term is. Mm. And so I wish that they had done it a little bit differently on that one. But anyways, I love that. So that's my
freakout. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like Ebony and I need to have a joint freakout one week about this.
We absolutely can and should, now that your ass is caught up. It took forever for you to get caught up.
I know.
I was holding all of this inside, but now I can let it flower. Let's do it.
It's because I don't like procedurals, and every time I tried to watch it again, I just didn't care, but it took me a little bit to get back. Like, I care about Sherlock and Watson. Mm-hmm. Like, that I care about their relationship. And so it took me a little bit to, like, get back into watching them. And also just, like, God, I love watching smart people.
Yeah.
Like, I just rewatched The Martian, and I love watching people be smart. Like, it's just super hyper competent. Mm-hmm. It's great. And so there's something really amazing about watching them work through these, even though you have to put aside all of the bullshit with the police and the state and all that kind of crap. So if you, bad transition, if you'd like to submit your own freak out, please do. It might make it in the show. And you can do that at feministfrequency.com/freakout. FREQ out. right, y'all, that's our show. You can catch us back here every single Wednesday. And remember that you too can join our podcast community and help us bring Feminist Frequency Radio to you every week at d.rip/femfreak. Hey, Carol.
Yo.
What can people do if they enjoy the show?
They can hire a skywriter to fly a plane in the sky to write the words, listen to Feminist Frequency Radio.
They could do that.
Yeah.
I feel like that might be a little outside of the wealth lines.
Ah, okay.
We're not friends with the Young family.
True, fair. Yeah.
They might listen to our podcast.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Okay.
They
what
could
else
also
can they do then? Yeah.
Rate and review us on iTunes.
Oh, okay. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And you can tell your friends mm-hmm. to check us out. You can find all of our work and our other podcasts at feministfrequency.com. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at FemFreak to stay up to date on all of the news. You can find me at Anita Sarkeesian.
I am Carolyn Michelle.
Ebony
and
has
this is where Ebony
disappeared.
Inserts her oh. jokey Twitter handle.
Except we lost Ebony. So you can find Ebony at Ebony Astor. Or whatever she comes up with this week. Our producer is Phil Circus, who also composed our theme music, technical support by Sarah Norales, and our art is by Jamie Varon. We'll see you next week.
Later.